his removal as a preacher, but his withdrawal from the church. And that wasn't what he needed. That didn't help him overcome that problem. That wasn't what needed to happen with that preacher. You know, he needed to work on it. He needed to overcome it. And the brethren there needed to be able to help him. And that's what we're going to talk about tonight. Really, the first point of tonight's lesson is if you know someone who has an addiction, if you love someone who has an addiction, or you're helping someone through that, not only do they need to realize that they need help, but you need to get them to realize it. That's a really, really hard thing to do. It's a hard thing to get someone who maybe won't admit that they need help to understand that they need help. It's even harder to get them to go and get that help, because sometimes people will say, okay, I know I need help, but I don't want to go get it, or I don't think I can get it, or I don't think that it will help. So that's the first thing that needs to happen. I know as much as you love someone, it's nice to be able to take care of some of these problems in-house, especially if it's your family. You know, you don't want a family issue to become a controversy in the community. But nonetheless, at some point you have to weigh the risk. If we keep this to ourselves, is it worth the risk of my friend or brother or family member never getting over it? Or would I rather them get over it and us be able to tell people, yeah, we had that problem and we overcame it? You need to get help, and you need to convince them to get help. Whether that means that you do something like an intervention, I know some people kind of frown on interventions. It's mushy stuff. Part of the reasons that mental health professionals recommend them is because they work. You know, whether it's more ideal, maybe you can just call them on the phone and say, hey, listen, I know that this is what you're into. You need to get help. And they say, yep, you're right. Whatever it is, you need to get them to get help. And that step alone may take a very, 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 very long time, which brings me to my next point. Get ready for a long haul. Helping someone with an addiction is a long-term commitment. This is where love is tested. I think Matthew 18 has so much that's relevant to not just addictions, but sin in general. We actually talked about this parable last week, but I like the application of the parable. We didn't specifically talk about this, but you might remember last week we referenced this parable, the kingdom of heaven. It's like a master who has a servant who owes him a lot. So that servant came to him and said, I can't pay it, and the master said, you're forgiven. So that servant then went out to another servant who didn't owe much, just a little bit, took him by the throat and shook him and said, repay me what you owe and put you in prison until you can pay the debt. And so in verse 32, the master summoned him and said to him, you wicked servant, I forgave you all that debt because you pleaded with me. And should not you have had mercy on your fellow servant as I had mercy on you? And in anger, his master delivered him to the jailers until he should pay all his debt. So also my heavenly Father will do to every one of you if you do not forgive your brother from your heart. You know, part of the understanding of this parable is knowing that God favors brethren who help brethren. You know, God favors brethren who treat other people with the same compassion that he's treated us. And you know that the amount of debt in this parable isn't so much relevant as the fact that both of those servants owed something. Every one of us owes something. Whether we consider our debt is small or whether we consider that our debt is great, every single one of us is in a position of debt to the master. God looks on us favorably when we help other people. And sometimes it's really helpful if we can just entirely dismiss the idea of whatever their sin is. I mean, obviously, say somebody's addicted to a prescription drug or something, you're going to need to keep in mind what it is because you don't want to be like taking it in front of them or something. You know what I mean? But if you can dismiss this person, don't think about that brother or that person as an addict. Think of them as a struggling, drowning soul, just like you once were. And that's the context of this parable. Look at verse 21. I'll put it up on the board. Peter came up to him and said to him, you guys have read this passage before. Lord, how often will my brother sin against me and I forgive him? As many as seven times. Now, you guys probably heard this talked about before too. Peter wasn't being literal. At least my understanding is that Peter wasn't being literal. You know, I don't think Peter was saying literally seven times. This is a Hebrew traditional number that meant the perfect number of times. My understanding of this passage is Peter was actually coming to Christ and saying, should I just keep forgiving my brother over and over and over and over and over? And Jesus said to him, I did not say to you 7 times, but 77 times, or some translations say 70 times 7. And I think some translations say 70 times 70. And I actually like that the translations are different here, because just like the amount of debt, this number is not the point. It's not even the attitude that's the point. It's not even, because Peter didn't, you know, have this attitude, Lord, I'm so forgiving, I'll just keep forgiving. That wasn't the point either. Jesus was saying, show mercy. And showing mercy means that every time you have an opportunity to forgive, you forgive. Show mercy. That was the point of the parable. You know, the master said to the servant, I had mercy on you. And so Jesus was answering, show mercy. Every time you have an opportunity to forgive, you forgive. Now that's a real hard principle, especially when it's applied to helping someone who's addicted. Because when someone is in the midst of their addiction, they don't think rationally. They're going to hurt you. They're going to do things that are offensive to you. They may even put you in danger. And that's why I said this is where love is tested. This is where mercy is tested. Because you have to be ready. When you commit to helping that person, you have to be ready to acknowledge that I'm going to do so to my own harm. It's going to hurt. I mean, if you have children who are in a position of experiencing addiction, or grandchildren, or even a family member, you know that heartbreak. You know it. Have mercy. Continue to help them. I'll tell you this too, statistically, and this was confirmed by my friend I told you all about, who helped me write this lesson. He said the reason that he remains clean, the longest periods that he's remained clean, I think I mentioned this morning, I've known him 15 years, and in that 15 years, he's relapsed once. I don't know how long it was, but it was years and years ago. But he said the reason that he remains clean, for the longest periods that he remains clean, is not because he really does anything differently. You know, this last and longest period of cleanliness on his part was because he incorporated his faith in God into it. It gave him some extra motivation or support. But the reason that he remains clean for long periods is because the people who are supporting him don't stop. When the people who are supporting him stop, he's quick to relapse. Even after years of staying clean, even after establishing a career like this last time, even after even starting a new family, he started a new family this last time. And it all blew up because the people, well, not just because, but that was a part of it, the people who were supporting him stopped. Now, at the same time, know your limits. This is something I think about all the time, especially you talk about Jesus, you know, his parable regarding counting the cost. Let's look at another parable, Luke 16. If you're helping someone who has an addiction, you need to have realistic limits. And then more difficult, probably, is you need to observe them. If you have the kind of love that is willing to be merciful to someone, you know, through an addiction, then you likely have the kind of love that will also let you make decisions that might put yourself or others in danger. So you should be ready, when you commit to helping someone with an addiction, to say, these are some specific limits I have, and if these limits are crossed, if these things are broken, these are some ways that we have to change the way we interact. That doesn't mean you stop loving them, or that you stop supporting them, but that you realistically evaluate your relationship and you're willing to change the way you're interacting with this person. This especially comes in handy when teaching someone the gospel, or when someone comes to the gospel and they come with an addiction, understanding that as their brother or as their teacher, I want what's absolutely best for them, but I also have to know that there are limits. In Luke 16, let's begin here in... I'm going to do some reading, and then I'll put a couple passages on the board. Let's start in verse 1. Jesus told a parable that I think a lot of people find confusing, but in verse 1 he said to the disciples, there was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to him that this man was wasting his possessions. And he called him and said to him, What is this that I hear about you? Turn in the account of your management, for you can no longer be manager. The manager said to himself, what shall I do since my master is taking the management away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I've decided what to do, so when I'm removed from management, people may receive me into their houses. So summoning his master's debtors one by one, he said to the first, how much do you owe my master? He said, 100 measures of oil. He said to him, take your bill and sit down quickly, and write 50. Then he said to another, how much do you owe? And he said, 800 measures of wheat. And he said to him, take your bill and write 80. Now I want to pause here. At your job, let's say you work at a bank, okay? And your boss comes to you and says, hey, you're going to be fired because we've caught you stealing from the bank. So you go and you find all the people who owe that bank money, and you say, hey, how much do you owe on that car or that house or that boat you bought? Give us half and we'll let it go. How do you think that your bosses would react? I'd imagine you'd probably go to jail. I mean, that's criminal in more ways than one. The way that this dishonest manager acted here was immoral, and yet, look at verse 8. The master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness, for the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into eternal dwellings. I think some translations there in verse 9 say earthly wealth or, you know, material wealth. I think that conclusion confuses some people, because what that manager did was dishonest, and yet Jesus says that the boss in this situation, the master, commended him, and then goes on to say the moral of the story is that you provide for yourself. You know, there's some more context here. At verse 10, he says, essentially, you know, what God gives you, be faithful in it, and God will give you more. And if you prove yourself unfaithful in it, God will remove what you have. That's probably the greater context of this parable. Nonetheless, what Jesus was commending here was being shrewd, being intelligent. And I think it's worth pointing out in this parable that the master of that house apparently did not still keep that manager on. It never says he still gave him his job. It just says he commended him, said that was a smart thing to do. It doesn't necessarily say. He said, yeah, that was a smart thing to do. Keep working for me, you stealing manager. You know what? He's not commending the immorality here. He's commending this shrewd decision that this man made. And I think it shows us something, too, about the interaction, the relationship between the master and this dishonest manager. You know, if you ask yourself this question, did that dishonest manager take advantage of the master? Definitely. Did he hurt him financially? Of course. You know, it certainly appears so. And what did that master do? Cut him off. Said he can't work here. And like I said, knowing these limits, setting these limits, and then enforcing them doesn't mean that you stop loving this person. I'll give you kind of an example of what this looks like. This friend of mine, we had a rule that if I ever suspected that he was using, he couldn't come over to, you know, my place. And we were never in that position. But if he had come over to my place one day while he was high, wouldn't have let him over anymore. Not at all. It didn't mean I didn't love him. Didn't mean I wasn't there for him. But just that he crossed the line we both set, and he couldn't do that. And I'm sorry I fell behind on my slide there. But that love is what is so important to this relationship that you have between yourself and the people who suffer addictions that you try to help. You know, and like we said this morning with someone who is addicted, gratitude is so important on the part of one who is addicted. You know, it's so important that someone who suffers from an addiction never bites the hand that feeds them, so to speak, or never slanders the person who's helping them or hurts them and behaves in a way that is grateful. It's also important, however, on the part of the one who is helping an addict to be open to receiving that kind of treatment, to recognizing it when it happens, and to knowing how much those two words mean, how much that thank you means. Because you're talking about a person who has lost control of self to some kind of substance. And having lost control of self it's a big deal if they are able to say thank you. I mean, even just say it. To get that from someone who's struggling with an addiction is like, it's like pure gold. And getting that from someone you're helping should help you understand that your limits, your love, it's working. That's part of the powerful message that the Bible gives us about sin in general, is it's never too late. So many people remain in addictions their entire lifetimes because they get convinced that it's too late. But it's never too late. Look back at Philippians chapter 2. We referenced this passage this morning. But this time, let's pick up in verse 12. We're going to read this passage, and as we do, try to picture the person described here. And ask yourself about this person. How would this person treat someone who suffered from an addiction? Verse 12 says, "Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now, not only in my presence, but much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who works in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. Do all things without grumbling or disputing, that you may be blameless and innocent, children of God without blemish in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world, holding fast to the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I may be proud that I did not run in vain or labor in vain. Even if I am to be poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrificial offering of your faith, I am glad and rejoice with you all. Likewise, you also should be glad and rejoice in me." As Christians, we frequently describe ourselves as lights to the world. One of the reasons that I love this passage is because Paul admits to the Philippians that they were in the midst of a crooked, in his words, crooked and twisted generation. I think sometimes something we take for granted as we read some of these letters is that the problems we struggle with today, if not exactly the same, are very similar to the problems that Christians struggled with to whom these letters were written. If you don't think there was a drug problem in Rome or Philippi, then you're kidding yourself. It was every bit as much of a diverse drug culture as in the U.S. today. And so Paul wrote to these people, yes, that crooked and twisted generation, that's what you're part of, but he said, shine as lights. If you want to bring light into the darkness of someone with an addictions world, help them overcome it. I don't know if I can describe, because it's not an experience that I've had, but the dark feeling of having no power over yourself, of being in an addiction. I can only imagine how incredible it must be to realize that Christ has power over us, owns us, and will do with us as he will, if we'll give ourselves over to him. And I can only imagine how grateful I would be to the person who pointed that out to me, the person who brought me out of that kind of darkness. I know when I was brought out of my own sin, I'd say light is a good description of it. When I was baptized, when I was forgiven, when I was saved, my whole world changed. So if you're helping someone who is struggling with addiction, look at it from that perspective. I'm going to emphasize this again because it's probably the greatest challenge to people who have the kind of love required to help out someone in an addictive position. That challenge is when do you know when to let go? When can you know when to cut them off? Ultimately, that's a question you have to answer for yourself. I mean, that has to do with what limits you're able to set. But whether you cut that person off or not, you never stop loving him. Never stop loving him. And never let them think you've stopped loving them. If they think it, it's got to be their fault. It's not because there's any evidence to support it. Continue to love. Continue to make yourself available to help. And again, of course, observe those limits you set, but you are the light in their world, so shine. It's probably the most powerful thing that a Christian can do to help someone who's struggling with an addiction. That's probably the thing that we need to keep in mind most as we teach people who are lost to addictions. As new brethren come into the body and they have addictions, as brethren fall away from addictions, remember, they're descending into darkness. We are that light. And in short, that's the answer as to what Christians can do. If you are helping someone who is struggling with an addiction, by all means, please, 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 please get them to realize that they need help. I think that's probably one of the most important tangible steps, is that you get them into some kind of recovery program. And it's not that recovery programs always work. A lot of that has to do with the individual going through that. But they need to be in it, and they need to be in it, and they need to be invested in it. And the second is realize that you are in for a long haul. It's going to be a long journey, exhausting and painful. Love them through it. Be that light in the world. That person in Philippians 2 is certainly who I hope to be to anyone who might be in that position. And if there's something in your life tonight that is keeping you from God, if it's an addiction, if it's just a sin, if you need to be baptized, I want you to look around this room. These are the brightest lights I know of in the world, these brethren here. You know, this morning we made the point that you shouldn't just get help from God or from some kind of recovery program, but from your brethren as well. And brethren, I know that you're ready to help anyone who has any need. So look around if you're in need. These are going to be the most powerful people, best qualified to help you of anyone else in this world. Don't be afraid to confess a sin. Don't be afraid to ask for help. Don't be afraid to come to Christ in baptism. And if there's anything that we can do to help you do any of those things, then let us know as we stand and sing.